This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning, I'm David Green.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. J.K. Rowling has a new novel. She has moved away from Harry Potter, the boy wizard whose stories prompted millions of kids, including mine, to obsess over books big enough to serve as doorstops. Having concluded that series, she's written a novel for grown-ups, a story of troubled teenagers and their even more troubled parents. A local politician in an English town drops dead, prompting people who knew him not to mourn, but to start asking what his suddenly empty seat on the town council could mean for them. There is no magic in the casual vacancy, though readers of the Potter books may well recognize Rowling's acute and often painful observations of human nature. Why write this book on this subject?
Because, as I think most writers would tell you, I just needed to write this book. It was an idea that came to me in 2007. I had the idea actually in the States. I was on tour promoting the last in the Potter series, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, and I was on a plane and had the idea for the casual vacancy. And exactly as had happened with Harry Potter, I knew it was something I really, really wanted to write. I became excited about the idea of writing it. It's a very personal book in a lot of ways. It's not a memoir. I'm not in the book. It's not my story. But it does address themes, subjects that are very important to me. And so that was the starting point.
Started on a plane in the United States. I wonder why there, because it was a plane and you had time to yourself?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there appears to be something to do with vehicles and movement that stimulates my writing. Obviously, it was a train with Harry Potter. I wasn't actually on my own. I was traveling with my family and with people from my publisher. And I can't even tell you why I had this idea at this time, but there it was. The basic idea was for a small town election occasioned by the death of a man who had been a lot of things to a lot of people in the town, and what happened in the aftermath of his death. And even then, I knew that there would be an element of subversion in the story.
Subversion.
And that comes largely from the teenagers, in that they attempt to influence what's going on.
Even though there are a lot of adult characters in this book, in the end, it does revolve around young people, a handful of them.
The teenagers definitely drive the plot. There are five teenagers, and they are simultaneously victims, protagonists, and in one case, I suppose that the whole plot revolves around the question of what we do with someone like this particular teenage girl who's Crystal. She comes from a very deprived family. She's rather disruptive in school. There are just a lot of aspects to her situation that interest me, and in some ways for very personal reasons, because as is very well documented, I too have passed through a period of poverty in Britain and can understand some of those issues.
Give me a better idea of what you mean there. Explain that for people.
Well, I think that I've had a very strange life. I've passed through a lot of different economic states in my life. My family was not particularly well off, although I came from a middle class and pretty well educated family. I attended a school very like the school that's depicted in the book, which means that it's a state-run school full of children from all kinds of different backgrounds. And then there came a point after the breakdown of my first marriage when, as I say, is very well documented, I existed on, for a while exclusively, on welfare, mm-hmm. on what we call benefits and you call welfare.
Would you help us understand a little bit the class system in Britain? Because
I'm not qualified to do it. I'll say that I'm really not qualified to do it because this book's set in England, so I'm going to say English, although I now live and work in Scotland. But I think you could ask 10 English people the same question about class and get a very different answer. Social mobility is one of the great issues of the day here, as I'm sure it is in America. I grew up in what I would call a lower middle class family. Not too far back, this was a very working class family. So I don't think that I had I know for a fact I didn't have a very grandiose upbringing. And I'm not really qualified to speak about the subject of class, except from my point of view.
Well, I'm curious if you, as you went through the changes of your life, if you had difficulty being accepted by people from other classes, even as you started making lots of money.
No, I wouldn't say that happened. I would say that I have many times met with the assumption that my attitudes have changed much more than they have towards people who are still in the kind of situation I once was. In other words, Well, I can think of a very recent example. I don't know whether you'll know this expression, but a man said to me, he told me where he lived, and he said, now, of course, we have no riffraff around there. And by, you do understand the expression clearly.
Yes.
And his assumption was that I would be glad to have kept out of my area the kind of person that I used to be, because I think, you know, not that long ago he would have considered me riffraff too.
And it's in that tension between the upper classes and the so-called riffraff that J.K. Rowling finds much of the tension in her novel, The Casual Vacancy. We're going to hear more of our conversation tomorrow when Rowling talks of depicting teenagers and of what her own teenage daughter thought of the book.
Charles Rowan Bai is a retired professor of ancient Greek, but his new memoir, My Husband and My Wives, A Gay Man's Odyssey, tells a tale that's startlingly contemporary. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Given the glut of autobiographies these days, a provocative subject alone isn't enough to snag a reader's attention. Although admittedly, the title of Charles Rowan Bai's new memoir, My Husband and My Wives, is certainly arresting. It's Bai's charming raconteur's voice, however, and his refusal to bend anecdotes into the expected lessons that really makes this memoir such a knockout. Bai won me over in his introduction when he admitted that, looking back at the long span of his life, he's now over 80, the big question he still asks himself is, what was that all about? That is a saga that begins in Iowa in 1930, where Bai was born into a Midwestern WASP family. He and his five siblings were schooled in the upper-class art of making conversation, or as he deems it, hiding behind brilliance. Awkward realities were politely ignored. Bai tells a nightmare Downton Abbey-type tale about sitting down to breakfast as a child when the family's aged serving woman was suddenly struck with a seizure of some sort while passing toast on a silver salver. Rather than leaping to this poor retainer's aid, the children took their cue from their mother, who held them all in her gaze and kept making insistently pleasant conversation until the poor woman staggered back to the kitchen, out of sight. Eventually, however, even Bai's mother couldn't blink away his budding homosexuality. Bai was in junior high and enjoying a limited menu of sexual adventures with mostly straight boys when the local Episcopal priest informed Bai's mother that her son's name was scrawled, along with a sexual slur, on a men's room wall. Mother promptly dispatched her wayward son to a psychiatrist, who, counter to almost every other psychiatrist in every work of gay literature ever written, turns out to be a compassionate man. The shrink simply counsels the 15-year-old Bai to be more discreet. Things take an even more unexpected turn when Bai meets an intellectually sparkling woman named Mary in college, and at the end of their first hour of conversation in a drugstore booth, Bai looks at her and declares, "This has been great. I think we should get married." At 21, he had never slept with a woman. Nevertheless, they do marry happily. And when Mary suddenly dies of a freak heart condition a few years later, Bai remarries and fathers four children, all along maintaining his core identity as a gay man and enjoying an abundant sex life described in great fleshy detail here with gay and straight men. Bai's story is a complex, poignant addition to the sexual canon. While he seems to have been blessedly free of the standard sexual guilt growing up, he was also acutely aware of the cost of being different. Here, for instance, is how Bai recalls a Christmas dance his mother made him host at their house during high school. "The dance was a great success. It was a moment in my life that I would never visit again. Within a short time, I would come to know affection blended with amusement or condescension or acceptance or forgiveness, take all the vocabulary for the attitudes with which one views a freak, an anomaly. In every other gathering in later years, I had to hold the crowd at bay, whether dancing, dining, toasting, laughing, telling stories, flirting, charming, I was always cornered." As emotionally charged as Bai's moments of sexual self-scrutiny can be, he's downright sarcastic when talking about his public career in academia. Now retired, Bai was a professor of ancient Greek, and he came of academic age in the era when an old boys' network of hail fellow well-met senior professors arranged jobs for their acolytes over martini-soaked dinners. Sloshing into one of those positions at Stanford, Bai confronts a lineup of eccentrically hostile colleagues. When he dares to pipe up at a faculty meeting, one of those colleagues, a rare elderly lady, turns to him and shouts, "Shut up, you mutt, you're new here." For Bai, the life of the mind affords nearly as many baffling encounters as does the life of the body. Bai's memoir ends on a joyous note. He and his husband of the title have been married for some 4 years, together for 20. Bowing to his background in ancient Greek, Bai subtitled his memoir, A Gay Man's Odyssey. But he might just as well have availed himself of the affirmative LGBTQ slogan, It Gets Better.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed My Husband and My Wives, A Gay Man's Odyssey by Charles Rowan Bai. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. And you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air and on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. I'm Terry Gross.
You could fill a library with all of the books that serve as love letters to New York City. And we have another to add to the shelf. It's Mark Helprin's new near-epic novel, In Sunlight and in Shadow. Our reviewer, Ellen Chu, says it makes life in the city just after the Second World War seem marvelous.
To be in New York on a beautiful day is to feel razor close to being in love, Helprin writes. This is a grand old-fashioned love story, he gives us, slathered in lush language, which begins with a Hollywoodish meet-cute on the Staten Island ferry. It's spring 1946. 32-year-old former commando-turned-businessman, a Manhattanite named Harry Copeland, who's recently returned from the European theater, boards the ferry, locks eyes with another passenger, a disturbingly attractive young woman named Catherine, and everything changes for both of them. Off they go on a journey together, bound by sudden passion, growing admiration, affection, even adoration, the whole business of a major, major love affair that leads to a marriage and beyond. Of course, first Harry has to get her skunky fiancé out of the way. Next, Harry and Catherine have to deal with the overt anti-Semitism of upper echelon New York society, a struggle that turns with a wickedly ironic twist as the story unfolds. And Harry declares war on a mafia boss who wants to bleed his family's high-end leather goods business dry, while Catherine pursues what she hopes will become a brilliant career in the Broadway musical. As we learn from long chapters that take us in the middle of the book back to the war against the Nazis, Harry knows how to fight. And as we hear from the chapters on Catherine's reach for success as a stage performer, she knows how to sing. Helprin does both things extraordinarily well, writing in a pitch close to a Broadway musical score and winning our close sympathy for his characters by means of his full-throated rendering of life at war and life at peace. I was desperately disappointed, though, by the end of this grandly charming and deeply affecting novel, not because of how it ended, but because it ended at all.
That's Ellen Chews reviewing Mark Helprin's novel In Sunlight and in Shadow, which comes out next week. You can get an advance peek. There's an excerpt at our website, npr.org. This is NPR. The novel Gone with the Wind by Margaret Mitchell is an American classic. As with any great book, it inspires wildly different responses from readers. It's also the subject of our latest PG-13, where we hear from authors about the books that introduced them to the world of adult ideas. Fittingly, we have not one but two different reactions to Gone with the Wind from two writers. First, an appreciation. When she was a kid, Jodi Picco fell in love with the book, especially the romance between its central characters, Scarlett and Rhett.
I was one of those kids, always had a book in my hand, always fell asleep reading. So you can imagine my shock when I brought home a book by Judy Blume, and my mother said I wasn't allowed to read it. What gives? It's the sex, my mom said. Well, what's a teenager to do? I went back to the library and found a different book that was all about relationships, but I made sure to pick one my mother couldn't possibly say no to. A classic. And that was the beginning of my literary love affair with Gone with the Wind. Scarlett O'Hara was nothing like me. She was a flirt. She was manipulative. Right from that first time she throws a tantrum over Ashley, and Rhett Butler happens to see it, I memorized the entire scene, and I recited it all the time. Sir, you are no gentleman, and you, miss, are no lady. Scarlett was this little girl imagining herself as a woman. She's really just a teenager who's not ready for the complexities of relationships, but thinks she's an expert. Sound familiar? There is sex in Gone with the Wind, but it happens between the lines. And in the end, I don't even think that's what I wanted anyway. I wanted to learn about relationships and how they can be romantic, but also bitter and devastating. I don't think I could have picked a better book. For the record, I still have never read that Judy Blume book, but I've read and reread Gone with the Wind half a dozen times.
That's Jodi Picco talking about how she discovered Gone with the Wind. Now to author Jesmyn Ward, who also read the book when she was young, knowing it was supposed to be a classic, but she had a different reaction.
I was not impressed. I felt bad for Rhett that he fell in love with an idiot like Scarlett. She was conniving and dim-witted, and what was she doing chasing Ashley for the whole book? I couldn't believe Mammy would stay at the plantation after she was free. And when I got to the part where Scarlett has to drive through Shantytown, my brain broke. I was dimly aware then that authors made choices. When I read the comparisons of black people to animals, I wondered, did Margaret Mitchell really see us like this? Do readers see us this way? When I finished the book and returned it to the library, I was different. Angry. Lonely. Years later, I reconnected with a former classmate. She told me she remembered that Gone with the Wind had been my favorite book in seventh grade. Really? I remember being intrigued and pretty horrified. Was Gone with the Wind my favorite book as a teenager? No. Was it one that taught me about America, about the South, about how others saw me? Was it one that made me want to resist those expectations and become something more? Absolutely, yes.
That's Jesmyn Ward, author of Salvage the Bones. And earlier we heard from Jodi Picco, author of Between the Lines, both with their teenage takes on Gone with the Wind by Margaret Mitchell. You're listening to All Things Considered.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. If we tell you that Clifford's turning 50, chances are you won't think of Clifford Lee, the famous Philadelphia Philly pitcher, or Clifford Chance, the big London law firm, but a big red dog. In fact, the big red dog, and Emily Elizabeth, the little girl who loves him. Norman Bridwell wrote the first Clifford the Big Red Dog story 50 years ago. Since then, he's written close to 90 more Clifford books that have sold more than 126 million copies in 13 languages. And Clifford's animated series on PBS is seen in 65 countries around the world.
Wow, Clifford, Lily LaValle picked you as Dog of the Year. But you're Dog of the Year every day to me.
This month, Clifford's publisher, Scholastic Press, is reissuing the original Clifford stories under the title The Clifford Collection. Norman Bridwell joins us from the studios of WCAI in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Thanks so much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
And you are joined by Norma Bridwell, your wife.
Yes.
Good morning, Mrs. Bridwell. How are you?
Good morning, Scott.
You both have a hand in this. How did Clifford get born?
It was 1962. I was a struggling, not very successful artist in New York. Norma said, well, you always wanted to illustrate children's books. Why don't you try that? I did about 10 paintings that I thought would appeal to children and took them to publishers and was rejected every place, except that one publisher, a young woman, said, well, you're not very good. She said, if you want to illustrate a book, you'll probably have to write one of your own. She pointed to a sample painting I'd done of a little girl with a gigantic red dog, and she said, maybe that's a story. And I went home, and over that weekend, I wrote the story Clifford the Big Red Dog and was shocked when it was accepted for publication because I'd never written anything before.
Norma Bridwell?
Yes.
What did you think about all this?
I couldn't believe it at first. When I did realize it wasn't a dream, I said to Norman, you could write another book. Maybe you could write two or three books. Who knows? And his reaction was, oh, no, this is just a fluke.
Clifford is bigger than a house, but once you accept that premise, he doesn't do any superhero stuff, right?
No, no. My editor was very wise to suggest he's, after all, just a dog. He's not, doesn't have magical powers.
Call it an accident at birth or something like that.
Now, Clifford grows big because he's loved so much?
Yeah, after I did, I think, four books of the Big Dog, I got letters from kids asking, what was he like when he was born? Was he a giant puppy? Was his mother and father big dogs? We thought it would be fun to make him a very small puppy. Mm-hmm. And he grew because Emily loved him.
Yes, he was the runt of the litter. And the man who was giving her a dog, a puppy, said, oh, don't take him. I don't think he'll even live. He's so small. Then love came in there and, you know, did the trick.
Is it hard to top yourself book after book with Clifford?
It has gotten more difficult over the years. Every time I think of an idea, I think, well, that's kind of like the idea that I did a couple of times before. Mm. And I'm running out of situations.
Mr. and Mrs. Bridwell, do you draw any lesson, and should we perhaps draw some lesson from the fact that you endured so many rejections and now are one of the best-selling authors in the world?
I often tell young people who write and say, I'd like to try writing a book. I always tell them, it's not easy. I said, I was extremely fortunate. It's a very discouraging business sometimes, but the rewards are marvelous, especially emotionally.
I have also read, Mr. and Mrs. Bridwell, that any kid in the world who writes you or writes Clifford a letter probably gets a reply.
We make a real effort to answer every letter. It's sometimes difficult, but I think if they care enough to sit down and write, I should give them an answer.
If Clifford grew so big because he was loved so much, after 126 billion books, shouldn't he be just about as big as Brazil right now?
That's a nice compliment.
I think he's reached his non-threatening limit.
Well, happy birthday to Clifford, and thank you very much. 50 years
thank
of
you.
Making children laugh. That's wonderful.
Thank you, Scott.
Norman Bridwell and Norma Bridwell, Clifford the Big Red Dog, is 50 years old.